Dies iri, dies ira, solvet secum in favilla, teste David cum sibilla.
No one has influenced the shape of Western history more than the man called Jesus Christ, and the story of his death and resurrection has inspired artists for centuries. The Art and Architecture series will be showing the 90-minute, high-definition, exhibition-on-screen production of Easter in Art, the greatest story ever painted, on Saturday, April 9th at 1 p.m. I spoke with Distinguished Professor of Art Alberto Rey to discuss three of the artists featured in the film, especially about their use of light in their work. Once again, a hearty welcome to one of my favorite guests, Distinguished Professor of Art Alberto Rey. Alberto, welcome once again.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure working with you, Tom.
Yeah, and I like having you on. I think maybe I'll find a way to carve you out a regular bi-monthly appearance or something like that.
That's fine with me.
Yeah, great. Great. So we have this exhibition on screen film coming up. It's part of the Art and Architecture series at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House, and it's called Easter in Art, the greatest story ever painted. And it's basically a curated look at some of the great paintings of Western art and sculpture as well that focus on the Easter story, the story of Christ's death and resurrection. And one of the things, you know, about Western civilization, when you look at it and its connection to the art world, is how tied in the Catholic Church and its imagery and iconography and story is to the development of the art scene in Western civilization. Why is that? How did that happen? What's the overall view there?
Well, one of the things is if you were an artist, you needed to have somebody sponsor your work. So you had more or less three major options. You had either a private patron or a business patron or the church. The Catholic Church had lots of money. And one of the things that was important about the church and why the artists wanted to work with the church is because it was a public venue. So if you got your work commissioned by a church, it would be available for the entire public to see. And it was a great way to promote your work. So if you did a work for a private donor or a private sponsor, it might end up in somebody's house, and the only people that would see it would be other donors and friends. So the best way to promote your work was through the church, and the church at the time, but throughout history, has had a wealth of money and willing to support, and all the cardinals or popes always wanted to be remembered by the work that they left, by the artwork that they sponsored and left behind.
Yeah, I think that certainly makes a lot of sense. And I know that the Catholic Church was invested in it because one of the ways they managed to get their story told was by pictures, because most people, you know, back then, the vast majority of people were illiterate. So seeing the artwork in the churches really helped them tell that story and keep the faith.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for a lot of them, they were actually included in the artwork. So it was another way of continuing with their legacy.
Right. So let's dive a little bit into it. I went ahead beforehand and had you pick three different artists from the, because we can't cover them all. So we decided to pick three different artists. And since you're the Distinguished Professor of Art, I decided to let you pick the three you wanted to talk about. So why don't we get into that? Who's the first artist whose work you'd like to discuss that's going to appear in this documentary?
So we're going to talk about Michelangelo. Now, everybody knows Michelangelo. The reason everybody knows Michelangelo is because he could do it all. He could not only do it well, but he was exceptional. Probably one of the best, not only muralists, but sculptors and painters. I mean, even to this day, if you look back at his work, you're like, how could this person do this? And that type of legacy and intimidation for artists continues to this day. If you look at any of his sculptures, it's just phenomenal. And he's a person just like anybody else. But he had this skill and had this commitment to his work that just allowed him to produce a ton of great work. And his work really influenced artists for centuries afterwards. One of the things I'm going to talk about briefly, because it affects the other two artists we look at, is how he uses light in his paintings. If you look at most of his work, the compositions are fully lit. That means that there is light on the whole composition. Everything is important. The figures are fully formed by shading and color, but everything has a full sense of light. So if you look at his murals or his paintings, you can see how he controls that. He wants to create this environment where everything in the environment is important. And his use of figures is pretty important because during, you know, the 1500s, the use of space and perspective was something was still pretty new. And the way he was layering information and figures and buildings created this sense of space and perspective that had not been done this well. And so people were just mesmerized by how realistic it looked and how this layering and sense of space was being done now that wasn't done in the past. And again, just the sheer volume and quality of the work just continues.
Well, when I was 12 or so, I think, when the World's Fair, 1964 World's Fair in New York City was up, and the Pietà, which I think is one of the pieces featured here, was at the Vatican exhibition room. And I remember going through it three times because it was, you were on a runway and you had to kind of, you weren't allowed to walk or linger. You just had to stand on the ramp and it slowly brought you by so that they could move the crowds. And I wanted to go through three times. And one of the things I remember being so struck about was the way that the stonework captured the emotion. I mean, the face of the Christ figure, the face of the Mary figure were just so full of emotion to me. It was, I remember being a 12-year-old, I was like, this thing is going to jump to life any minute.
You right. know? And it's marble.
Yeah.
You know, if you break off a piece of that finger or arm or leg, you can't put that sucker back on. That's it.
That's it.
And yeah. Those folds are just super thin. And just like you're saying, it's just so elegant. So it's not only the technician that he was, but just the aesthetic, spiritual beauty that he was able to create with something as unforgiving and as difficult as marble.
Yeah. Yeah. A rare talent in the history of Western art, for sure. Who's the next artist we're going to discuss?
Caravaggio. Ah. Now, the thing with Caravaggio is he is the complete opposite of Michelangelo. Every artist after Michelangelo was like, he was the god. You had to kind of do things the way Michelangelo did. A lot of preparatory work, a lot of drawings, a lot of layering images, layering glazes. Here comes Caravaggio. He decides that he's going to use dramatic lighting, only like a spotlight on these images. And he's not going to do any drawings. He's going to do everything completely from life. So if you look at his work, it's like a spotlight, very dramatic. Something called chiaroscuro, which was more or less the control of light in a way that makes it very dramatic. Everything is kind of focused in, very different. And he was also, Michelangelo died at 88. Mm-hmm. And which, you know, if you can work that long, it gives you a lot of opportunities to make good work. But Caravaggio died at 39. Mm. And the reason was that Caravaggio got into fights all the time. And he actually had a contract on him. He actually murdered somebody in Rome, had to leave Rome. And he ended up dying on the way back to Rome after he got a pardon, because the cardinal at the time wanted him to do some more work. Mm-hmm. But he ended up mysteriously of a fever on his way back, and his body was never found. They just started to do some DNA work on a set of bones that they believe now that they are Caravaggio. So kind of very strange, crazy life, much different than this kind of rock steady, just work ethic that Michelangelo had set up. And so a lot of Caravaggio's peers, artists, were just, not only were they kind of upset that he was kind of breaking from this classical mold, but he was creating this sense of realism in his work that was unheard of. It was unlike anything before. And a lot of his commissions were rejected because they were so real that they considered them vulgar. Wow. That some of the information they put in that in previous times have been smoothed over or glossed over, he didn't do that. He put all the imperfections that these individuals had. And that's what made the work so powerful. The gestures, the narrative, the storytelling, and the brushwork that he developed more towards the end of his life. So I mean, he's probably one of my favorite artists just because of the control of light.
Well, I had to agree with you in a sense. The piece that they're going to show, I think, in the film is the Supper at Emmaus. But I have another story about that too, because I went to London for one of the theater department's like London tours back, you know, a number of years ago, and I took the time to spend to take the Channel to France, and 7 hours. I spent 7 hours in France, and I went to the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa, which was a disappointment. We'll talk about that another time. But as I was going through, all of a sudden, there's a Caravaggio, it's a crucifixion. And I was like, I just turned around and it was there, you know, just like it was there. And it like knocked me right over, because the way he has that light, you know, figured around the crucified Christ, which just fades all the way to black around the edges of the painting, was just stunning. And it's like, wow. You know, that was my reaction to it. I know that's not a sophisticated reaction, but wow.
No. I mean, it's, and especially for the time, it wasn't like there was a lot of other artists doing it to this magnitude. The amount of realism and control of light was just, you know, shocking. And I mean, if you can, you know, this is before, obviously before photography. So you see something like this, it's got to be just mind-boggling to see something this realistic in a two-dimensional form.
Yeah, absolutely. So who's the final artist?
We're going to go with Rembrandt.
Rembrandt, all right.
And Rembrandt, kind of an interesting guy. I think everybody's heard of Rembrandt. But, you know, he had a kind of an interesting life in that he never left the Netherlands. He was pretty much a portrait artist. That was his trade, but he did a lot of religious imagery as well. His life was filled with, you know, sadness. He was married, his wife died, and then all four of his kids died. And he did have a partner, but through his wife's inheritance, the only way he could keep her fortune was if he never remarried, so he never did. Hmm. But he was able to just continue to do these portraits. And one of the things I like about Rembrandt is very similar, and I think he was influenced also by Caravaggio, was his lighting, if you look at Rembrandt's lighting and his work. But one thing that Rembrandt did that took it a step further was that, especially later in life, he was one of the first artists who actually applied paint to the canvas with a palette knife. He wanted to create so much thick gestural brushwork that he felt that this was the best way to do it, to not only to not start with a paintbrush, which would again start with something smooth, but to actually start with something that was thick, and then you could carve into it on the canvas. This was something that was fairly new. And so if you combine that with the lighting and the gestural kind of spiritual signature mark making, it goes beyond realism in that it incorporates a sense of personal mark making that cannot be done with, you know, washes or glazes. So it was pretty important. And then his prints are really beautiful. Again, controlling light, but for the small scale that they are, he was able to put in a lot of information, and a lot of his religious imagery, especially from the prints, was very powerful. He unfortunately died a pauper, unmarked grave. And then a few years later, as they do with all people who pass away without any funds, they dug up his body and destroyed it. Oh. So there's no more remains of Rembrandt anywhere.
You got some really interesting insights onto their life, the lives of these guys.
I think that's really a fun little thing to think about. I think is the reason I say all that is because I see it in the work. You know, an artist, like a poet, like a writer, it reflects their life and their work. So you can't separate the two. So whatever happens in your life kind of intuitively comes through the painting as well.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the people who go to enjoy this particular documentary, Easter in Art, are probably going to get a better insight into it when they watch these particular, you know, artists come through. I also, there are so many others we could talk about: Rubens, Dali, Da Vinci, Leonardo da Vinci. But I think we're going to leave it at the three, Alberto. And let me thank you for the time and that you give us all the time. And I really appreciate the expertise, so that you know, the listeners can get a good little extra insight into what they're going to see.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. It's always a pleasure. I'm certainly not an expert, but I'm looking at it as a fellow artist looking at other artists' work, and this is what I find fascinating about their work, and I wanted to share that with everybody else.
Great, great. Thanks a lot. I'm sure we'll have you again, Alberto. There's more films to come, so you take care until I get a chance to talk to you again.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom.
All right. Bye-bye.